cells, T cells. All your body's defenses against infection and cellular damage will decline, steeply.
But if I've got the nanos in me, I won't need them, will I?
That's right, she said, so faintly Grant could barely hear her. You won't.
So what's the problem?
You'll be chained to those nanomachines, Grant. Like I said, you'll be heading along a one-way street. Once you start taking nanotherapy, you'll have to stay with it for life.
Grant thought it over for all of 5 seconds. Okay by me, he said. Cardenas smiled sadly.
Easy enough for you to say, Grant. But the nanomachines have finite lifetimes. They break down eventually.
You'll need to replenish them from time to time. I see.
You'll be hooked on them, just as you might become hooked on narcotics or alcohol.
Grant saw that she was trying to give him the whole picture before he made a decision that he'd have to live with for the rest of his life. You're living with them, aren't you? He asked.
Yes, I am.
And you seem to be doing okay. Fine, in fact.
But I can never go back to Earth. Never go home. I'm an exile, Grant.
I'm not going back to Earth either, he said. I've got nothing to lose.
She looked surprised. I remember you told me that before, but are you certain? Absolutely certain?
It's a decision that you'll have to live with for the rest of your life. Which could be centuries long, from what I've heard. Cardenas almost smiled.
Yes, you could live for a long time, with nanos protecting you.
Grant reached out and clutched her hand. I'll take the chance.
You're sure?
I'm sure. And thanks for the warning. I appreciate how much you care. Cardenas seemed to brighten, as if a weight had been taken off her shoulders.
All right, Grant, she said. Come down to my lab tomorrow evening, and I'll have the nanos waiting for you.
8 weeks later. You'll be all right, Trudy told herself as she stepped out of the airlock and onto the open floor of the Sea of Moscow.
Just don't look up. Keep your eyes straight ahead and don't look at the stars.
She was following Winston Squared out to one of the spindly little hoppers standing near the blast pad where the bigger, more powerful lobbers landed and lifted off.
The nanobots have finished the mirror at Mendeleev Crater, she said.
She knew that Winston knew that. Everybody at Farside knew it. But Trudy needed something to chatter about.
Now Grant's getting them started on the mirror at Korolev. At this rate, we'll have all three telescopes working before the end of the year.
Yeah, that's good, Winston said. And Cyclops is starting to get data from the antennas we've already put up. The prof's a happy camper.
You're looking for intelligent signals? Trudy asked.
With a cynical little chuckle, Winston said,
the great and wonderful search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The more we look, the less we find. I thought SETI... Trudy, radio telescopes have been searching for intelligent signals for more than a century, with nothing to show for it.
You're not using Cyclops for SETI? Oh, sure. We're scanning for intelligent signals. But it's strictly routine. Nobody expects to find anything.
But you said you were getting data, Trudy said,
keeping her eyes focused on his space-suited back a few paces ahead of her.
We sure are, he replied, brightening. We're looking at the afterglow from gamma-ray bursters. Exploded superstars, 3-4 megaparsecs out. Hypernovas? Trudy asked.
You know about them?
Only a little, she said.
The hopper was about 100 paces ahead of them, a flimsy-looking craft, little more than a platform resting on spidery legs. Trudy knew that Crater Mendeleev was nearly 800 kilometers away, and Winston had been ordered by Professor Ulrich to fly her there.
Sounds like interesting work, she said.
Not as glamorous as talking to ETs, Winston replied, but it sure as hell interests me and the rest of the Cyclops crew. She nodded inside her fishbowl helmet. The Cyclops assembly would be the biggest and most sensitive radio telescope facility in the solar system, she knew, capable of picking up intelligent radio signals from thousands of light-years distance. If there are any intelligent signals out there, she added silently. They reached the hopper, and Winston put a booted foot on its frail-looking ladder, then stopped and turned toward her.
Ladies first, he said with a stiff little bow.
Thinking that there are advantages to being one of the few women at this lonely outpost, Trudy grabbed a rung and started up the ladder. She felt the rung sag slightly as she put her weight on it, but ignored that and clambered laboriously in her bulky spacesuit up to the open platform. Following right behind her, Winston went to the control console, nothing more than a slender podium at one edge of the platform. She stood beside him and clutched the slim railing with both her gloved hands. "Better slip your boots into the loops on the deck," Winston told her. "These little buggies don't generate many G's, but still you want to be anchored down good and tight."
"How long will it take to get to Mendeleev?" she asked.
"We're scheduled for 45 minutes. Could go faster, but that'd burn up too much of our fuel."
Trudy felt her pulse thumping in her ears as Winston went through the brief checkout procedure, and then asked the flight controller, safe and snug back in Farside's underground shelter, for permission to lift off.
"You are cleared for liftoff," she heard in the speakers built into her helmet. Winston said, "Okay, here we go."
The sudden surge of acceleration made Trudy's knees buckle, but she held tight to the railing and straightened up immediately. The ground fell away, and all at once they were soaring up, higher and higher, as if they were riding a magic carpet. No sound, no feeling of wind rushing by. It was almost as if she were watching a 3D video.
"Fun, isn't it?" Winston asked, his voice light and carefree.
"Sort of," Trudy replied cautiously.
She could see the barren, pitted ground sliding past them far below, pockmarked with craters, studded with rocks.
"I'm flying across the moon," she told herself. She felt lightheaded, and her insides began to churn.
"We'll be weightless most of the flight," Winston said cheerily. "Feels great, doesn't it?"
"Sort of," was all that Trudy could say. Her stomach was crawling up toward her throat, and she felt that if she let go of the railing, she would float off into infinity. Squeezing her eyes shut, she commanded herself to ignore the queasiness. Forget about it. Forget the cosmic emptiness out there. Think of something else, something pleasant.
She thought back to her date with Carter McClintock. They had bumped into each other in the cafeteria. Over the months since she'd arrived at Farside, they saw each other daily, of course. But 2 days ago, there in the cafeteria, Carter had asked her to have dinner with him in his quarters. "I'm afraid I'm not much of a cook," he had said, a rueful expression on his handsome face. "But then there's not much available here except prepackaged meals."
"That's okay," Trudy had said brightly. "I can perform miracles with a microwave."
"Can you? How wonderful."
McClintock's quarters were somehow more luxurious than Trudy's. The place was the same size as hers, and had the same standard-issue sofa and chairs, desk and wall screens, the same kind of kitchenette, the same-sized bed. But McClintock had a real carpet on the floor, a red-patterned oriental, and the coffee table in front of the sofa was a handsome curved piece of glass, not the more practical boxy type that Trudy had in her room. An additional flat screen was mounted on the wall over the sofa. It showed an image of some famous painting of a woman and her little boy on a green summery hilltop.
"It's not much," he'd said as he showed her in, "but it's home. For now." Trudy had worn her best dress, a sleeveless, short-skirted thing of buttercup yellow, and she'd spent nearly an hour trying to make her hair look decent. McClintock was wearing a casual sweater, coppery red, and neatly pressed slacks. With a wily grin, he said, "I smuggled some wine from California in with the latest supply delivery. Would you like some?" Dinner was wonderful. The food was quite ordinary, but Carter was a good conversationalist and kept her laughing with stories about his family Earthside. She wound up in his arms on the sofa, her heart pounding so strongly she thought he'd hear it, or maybe even feel it, as he held her close. She had to take a breath before she could continue.
"I haven't had much experience, Carter. With men, I mean."
"Neither have I," he whispered. "With men, that is." She giggled, and he began to undress her.
Yes, Trudy thought, there really is an advantage to being one of the few women at Farside.
"Starting retroburn in 10 seconds. Winston's voice broke into her reverie. Trudy blinked away the happy memory of her night with Carter McClintock and looked down past the edge of the hopper's gridwork decking. And there was the telescope, a big fat tube standing slightly tilted in the middle of Crater Mendeleev, like the stumpy old-fashioned smokestack of an ocean freighter. At its